This morning, in this hour of Focus 580, we'll explore the early years of England's first great female monarch, Elizabeth I. And our guest for the program is historian David Starkey. He's published a new biography of Elizabeth, which is titled Elizabeth, the Struggle for the Throne. It's published by HarperCollins. And indeed, it explores her birth, her youth, her early years. She certainly changed her country in ways that we can still see today. But at the very beginning, her rise to the throne was certainly anything but a certainty. We'll talk about the character of Elizabeth this morning with David Starkey. And of course, if people have questions, you're welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free, so that means if you're listening in Chicago, for example, or Southern Illinois or Western Indiana or any place, you can use our toll free line. That's 800-222-9455, 333-WILO. Toll free, 800-222-WILO. Just a little bit more of information on our guest. David Starkey is an historian and commentator. He's fellow of Fitzwilliam College, Cambridge. He's the author of several works on the Tudor period, including The Reign of Henry VIII and The English Court from the Wars of the Roses to the Civil War. His home is in London. Now he's spending some time in the United States talking about the book. He's in Chicago, and as a matter of fact, we'd like to mention for folks in the Chicago area that he will be at the University of Chicago bookstore for a reading and talk today, 4:30 in the afternoon. The bookstore is located at 970 East 58th. So anyone who's interested should feel free to attend. Of course, here on the program, if you would like to give us a call, you may do that. Mr. Starkey, hello.
Hello.
Thank you for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Not at all. I mean, I have, in fact, found interest in America really very impressive. I was talking in Chicago last night, actually, at the public library, and the size of audience, the enthusiasm, the involvement was really impressive.
Mm. Elizabeth is a compelling figure. I think perhaps one shouldn't be surprised she would be for British folks, but here in the United States, even, as she seems to be.
I think she's a kind of world figure. I mean, you get a handful of these people. Curiously enough, her father, Henry VIII, is the same. I was, a couple of days ago, I was over in Chicago doing the sort of thing that I'm doing now, and I noticed downtown in a rather cheap area, there was a sort of tall and big man shop called the Henry VIII store. And these figures seem to be, they're the kind of the English myths, the Tudors of the English myths, and mythic figures they reach right outside their own time, they reach tours across the centuries, and, you know, each age interprets them for itself. And obviously one of the reasons why Elizabeth is so interesting to people now is feminism. Mm. And the idea of a woman in power. I mean, Elizabeth actually hated the idea of other women in power, but we tend to see it differently.
As you say, Elizabeth's father was Henry VIII, her mother Anne Boleyn. Henry had gone to some trouble to dissolve his first marriage to Catherine of Aragon so he could marry Anne Boleyn, and his hope was a male heir. How did Henry feel about it when, indeed, the first child that Anne Boleyn had was a girl?
Well, he put a good face on it, as indeed did the mother. I mean, there was an obvious embarrassment. You cancelled some of the celebrations. They had organized tremendous tournaments, you know, games on horseback. They were cancelled. And Anne Boleyn had even had the letters announcing the birth of a prince written in advance, and they carefully insert S to turn it into the birth of a princess, things like that. But they put a good face on it. And in fact, Elizabeth, we were talking now about the status of women. Elizabeth, from the very moment of her birth, is proclaimed princess. That is, heir to the throne. In other words, she was treated as heir to the throne pending the birth of the son, of course, that didn't come by that marriage.
Mm. When Elizabeth was three, her mother was executed.
Mm.
And it seems that she bore no ill will against her father for her mother's death. And in fact, she apparently loved her father, held him in great regard. Now, perhaps it was because Elizabeth was only three, but in a way it seems a little surprising.
It seems very surprising, particularly because we tend to be Freudian about these things. You know, we see it in terms of modern psychology and psychoanalysis. And all I'm doing, David, is looking at what Elizabeth herself says. She never mentions her mother. and think in the whole of, you know, the next 40, 50 years of her life as an adult, there are two mentions of her mother, but her father's name is constantly on her lips. You see, it's very important that we understand, and one of the things I try to do in this book is to bring home the very, very different context of their lives. We tend to think of them as, you know, another kind of all-British or all-American family. You know, Henry and Anne are in bed, Elizabeth is in a cradle at the foot of the bed, Elizabeth starts crying, and Henry says, "Anne, you deal with it." It's not like that. The king and the queen lead almost completely separate lives. They have their own suites of private apartments. I mean, Henry's private rooms at Hampton Court cover an acre. And Elizabeth isn't brought up by her mother. She isn't even suckled by her mother. She's got a wet nurse who feeds her. She's got her own household. She's got her own palaces 20 miles from court. So the news of her mother's fall and death, horrible though it is, it just filters through into an existing secure world, and her closest relationships at this point and for a long time afterwards are with the men and the women who bring her up. Do you understand what I mean?
It's very different
from how this would play if they were all living together in a duplex.
Well, and it seems also to be the case in a very real sense that the most basic function the royals have is to reproduce themselves.
That's true. And of course, it particularly fell heavily on the woman, on the queen. Any problems in producing a male child, or indeed infertility, tended to be blamed on the woman. And if you look at how the queen is treated in terms of the rituals of the court, it's everything to do with her pregnancy, to do with this cycle. So the moment she's pregnant, it's not a private matter, it's something of public rejoicing. When they think the time of the birth is approaching, there's this immense ceremony in which her confinement, I mean, we still use the word, but then it meant something literally. The queen ceremonially withdrew from the life of the court, at which, of course, men were as heavily involved as women, into an all-female world into which men were absolutely forbidden. She was sort of locked up in a room that was like a luxuriously padded cell. We have to see this as you know, the essential female role, and it's this, of course, which Elizabeth's whole pattern of life challenges. I mean, she doesn't play that game.
Yeah. Well, it certainly seems to be the case that while Elizabeth was clearly an intelligent young woman, capable, strong personality, that she also benefited by receiving what would have been at the time a boy's education, not the kind of education that a woman, a court woman, who was destined simply to go on to be someone's wife and produce children, would have received.
Yes and no, aren't I being British? actually, what's really striking in this early phase of the Renaissance, in the early 16th century, the daughters, not only of monarchs, but of important noblemen and leading citizens, very often did receive an incredibly good education. It was almost as though they separated out in their minds the fact that this person is, you know, going to be essentially a breeding machine, a child-rearing machine, from the idea that they ought to be well-educated. And all Henry's children, Mary also, the elder daughter, are very, very well-educated. I think the difference with Elizabeth is that she was brilliantly intelligent, you know, incredibly receptive. So by her early teens, she's fluent in about five or six languages, in English, in Latin, in ancient Greek, in French, in Italian, some Spanish. And there's a wonderful remark by her tutor, who happens to be one of the greatest teachers of the age, a man called Roger Ascham, in which he's reviewing her achievements. And there's a moment of slight dismissiveness when he said, but her spoken ancient Greek was only moderately good. Well, she's fluent. She talks Latin as you and I speak English, and continues to do so right to the end of her life.
Our guest this morning, David Starkey, he's a historian. He's written several works on the Tudor period. The one that we're talking about here this morning is his most recent, which is titled Elizabeth, The Struggle for the Throne. It's published by HarperCollins. He's spending some time in the United States talking about the book. His home is in London. He's in Chicago and would welcome questions. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Henry had three children by three different women, Mary by his first wife, Catherine of Aragon, Elizabeth by his second, Anne Boleyn, and finally a boy, Edward, by his third wife, Jane Seymour. It seems to be the case that while Henry was alive, these three children got on rather well.
They get on reasonably well. I think they're always they're actually brought up together. It's the most surprising thing that Mary, of course, is much older than the other two. Mary's born in 1516, so she's 17 years older than Elizabeth. Elizabeth is 4 years older than Edward. But they are brought up together, away from court. They spend most of their time together. They only go to court. Well, Mary only starts to go to court from 1536. Elizabeth doesn't start to go to court until she's about 11 in 1544. But there, and say with their brother, both of them, both Mary and Elizabeth, like Edward and get on with him very well. Between Mary and Elizabeth, there is obviously the tension that Mary had been excluded from the succession. Her mother had been divorced and humiliated, all because of Anne Boleyn. And Mary bitterly hates Anne Boleyn, and she only starts to forgive her after she's been executed. So there's always a tension between the two, and it's natural, I think, nowadays with any family of half-siblings. I mean, children of different wives, I think, quite often have a problem in relating to each other, particularly if one of them identifies with the mother as having been wronged. And what's very clear, though Elizabeth doesn't particularly identify with Anne Boleyn, Mary completely identifies with Catherine of Aragon. So there's resentment, and it's intensified because both Mary and Elizabeth symbolize different religious positions. Mary is completely committed, enthusiastically committed to the old Catholic religion. Elizabeth is a symbol of the Reformation, a symbol of religious change. And so added to the personal tension, there's a religious one. Hmm. But they do rub along.
And one might expect that as when Edward was born, same thing happened to Elizabeth as happened to Mary before her. You would think that maybe there would be some common cause there between the two of them.
Well, yes, except that the one thing they do, as everybody did in the 16th century, is accept that the boy should come first. Hmm. I mean, everybody can accept Edward's position because, first of all, the marriage between Henry and Jane Seymour is undoubtedly a valid marriage. Henry had made sure of that by executing Anne beforehand, so he doesn't marry whilst he could already be sort of held to be married to somebody else. And also because everybody recognized that a boy automatically comes first in the succession. This isn't the modern world in that sense. There's no notion of equality between men and women.
When Henry died, his son, Edward, came to the throne. He was only 10. Elizabeth received what seemed to be, for the time, a rather generous annual income, the promise of a dowry if she should marry. Then she went to live with Henry's last wife, Catherine Parr, and her husband, Thomas Seymour, who seemed to show a rather unhealthy interest in his teenage stepdaughter. And in fact, when Catherine Parr died, Seymour decided that his way to power was to marry Elizabeth. And perhaps that actually would have happened had he not been charged with treason and executed. Elizabeth, through this whole episode, I gather, was lucky not to have been implicated herself.
Well, she was implicated because I'm afraid the unhealthy interest is very real. There are these extraordinary incidents of a kind of sexual play. There's one in which Catherine Parr holds Elizabeth's hands behind her back whilst Thomas Seymour cuts her dress off with a knife.
And we know that actually happened. Yeah.
We do, because we have, in fact, judicial investigation. You mentioned that Seymour was charged with treason. That's exactly the same as having a special prosecutor turned on you nowadays. In the U.S., every single thing that you have ever done is scrutinized. Everybody who's ever talked to you is interrogated, and all the documents survive. As you can imagine, the papers are electrifying, and they become more so once Elizabeth is queen, and they're seen as being so sensitive that her first minister, William Cecil, actually weeds them from the state archives. I mean, they're taken out of the files, and he takes them off home with him. They still survive.
Though Elizabeth, apparently, now as a teenager, even at a relatively young age, had had enough self-control to hold herself together through this. And apparently, even when she was told that Thomas Seymour had been beheaded, she didn't show any concern about that. Showed no emotional reaction.
Oh yes, yes. I mean, what she doesn't do, she doesn't sort of fling herself around weeping and wailing and say, "Oh my God." I mean, her first instinct is self-preservation. Quite understandably. I mean, how do I save myself from getting involved in this mess? And what she says all the time is she admits that these incidents took place. She admits to having strong feelings for Seymour. She even admits that she would have liked to have married him after Catherine Parr's death. But what she does emphasize is she would have only done this by going through the proper forms of seeking permission from the king and the council, which is what's laid out in the terms of her father's will. What is really striking, though, David, about it is the way in which she keeps control of the situation, the way in which she understands that the strategy to avoid being really badly damaged is this legalistic point about, I wouldn't have got married without permission. She sticks by that. And then the moment she senses the situation is swinging in her favor, you can see her going on the attack. And she's really concerned about the damage that's done to her public reputation. You can imagine rumors start circulating that she's pregnant by Seymour and whatever. And she writes to Seymour's brother, the Lord Protector, a man called Edward Seymour, Duke of Somerset. She writes to him, look, these rumors are terrible. They must be stopped. Somerset writes back and says, fine, tell me who's spreading them, and I'll deal with them. And Elizabeth says, oh, you don't want me actually to name people. If I'm seen to be naming people and get them punished, that will make me unpopular. She says, it will cause me to lose the favor of the people. And this is a 16-year-old girl, and you see her already aware of the crucial role of popularity, of reputation, of how you handle public image. I mean, it's as though she had a Madison Avenue image consultant whispering into her ear. And at 16, that's extraordinary.
Well, it is, and I suppose that has something to do with being raised in this political hothouse atmosphere that must have been court life.
That's terrifying. I mean, in which on the one, it's a bit, I suppose, like being a dot-com millionaire now. It's the sense of incredible excitement of being literally at the cutting edge, except the cutting edge then also involved the execution acts. It's an incredibly risky world, and Elizabeth is brought up with extraordinary insecurity. I mean, royal children nowadays, we look at the children of Queen Elizabeth II, they're brought up with immense security, material security, security of the succession. Elizabeth is completely the opposite, and what I try to say in my book is this tremendous sense of insecurity, of not knowing whether you'll live out any particular day, of not knowing who will be in power from one moment to the next. It's this and how she coped with it that actually makes her such an extraordinarily great politician and such a great ruler.
And you also suggested it's this whole business with Thomas Seymour that was a very important turning point in her life, was really her transition into adulthood.
I think it is. I mean, it's obviously a pretty horrible way to encounter sex for the first time. But what seems to happen is that all the men that she finds attractive in the future look like Thomas Seymour. Mm. The same physical type. They're tall, they're broad-shouldered, they're auburn-haired. It's as though he establishes her ideal man, her ideal type of manhood. And of course, all of them end in the same way that the Seymour affair did, sometimes in execution, always abortively. They never turn into marriage, and it's a pattern which constantly repeats itself.
It would seem that for her, the issue of her autonomy, not just in the royal sense, but perhaps in all senses, that for her was a lifelong issue. And when one asks this question, why is it that she never married? That seems to be the answer. That is, she wasn't interested in sharing power with anybody.
I think that's one of her concerns. I mean, I think Elizabeth, David, is actually split on the idea of marriage. I mean, on the one hand, it's clear she's immensely jealous of power and authority and riches and autonomy. I mean, as you hinted, this enormous fortune that she's left by her father is really conditional on the fact that she doesn't marry. She's given what amounts to sort of five English counties to the northwest of London. It's a huge fortune. She's 20 houses. She enters London attended by 2,000 or 3,000 people. A house in London is Somerset House, which is grander and more modern than the King's own palace. But all of this goes the moment she marries. So you can see her sense of possible loss. Equally, she is, as the affair with Seymour demonstrates, she is very highly sexed. All this stuff about her, you know, not being gynecologically normal or whatever is nonsense. We know the result of medical examinations. They all say she is normal. We know that her women don't gossip and say, oh, she's not having periods or whatever. She does. So she's a perfectly ordinary, healthy woman with a normal interest in men. And there's this terrible tension between her desire to exercise power and authority and her desire to have a man. And she sees, of course, in the case of her sister, we've talked a little bit about Mary, when Mary becomes queen, the thing that destroys Mary is the fact of her womanhood, the fact that she marries an unsuitable man, that she has a phantom pregnancy, which leads to complete humiliation, that she's deserted by her husband and deserted by power. It's her womanliness that destroys her. And Elizabeth, I think, learns from that and decides, I'm not going to do it. But it's at a terrible price, I think. She turns into a bitter old maid because of it.
Well, again, let's introduce the guest this morning in this hour of Focus 580. We're speaking with historian David Starkey. He's fellow of Fitzwilliam College, Cambridge, and has written a number of works on the Tudor period in England, including The Reign of Henry VIII and The English Court, from the Wars of the Roses to the Civil War. His most recent is a biography of Elizabeth I, titled Elizabeth, the Struggle for the Throne, published by HarperCollins. He's in Chicago, has been spending some time in the United States talking about the book, and he will be giving a talk and a reading at the University of Chicago Bookstore at 4:30 this afternoon. That's at 970 East 58th. So if you're in Chicago and you would like to hear more from the guest, you can attend. And, of course, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Elizabeth did, at least earlier in her life, have relations with men. That is, there were men who were interested in and they in her. And one of those that you write about in the book was Robert Dudley, the Earl of Leicester, who apparently was someone much in the mold of Thomas Seymour, as you suggest, someone that maybe, had things gone differently, they might have married. Tell us about Robert Dudley.
Well, he is the son of John Dudley, the Duke of Northumberland, who takes over the government of England for Edward VI after the fall of Edward Seymour, because Elizabeth, again, one of the elements in Elizabeth that I constantly emphasize, she had incredibly good luck. After that dreadful incident with Thomas Seymour and Seymour's execution, his elder brother, the man who'd brought him down and had humiliated Elizabeth, he loses power very quickly, and Elizabeth becomes flavor of the month with this new regime headed up by John Dudley. And one of John Dudley's sons is Robert Dudley, later on Earl of Leicester, and he is brought up with the royal children. He forms part of Edward's household, and as Edward's household is under the same, that's King Edward's household, Prince Edward's household, and as that household is under the same roof as Elizabeth, there are very close contacts with them that go right back to the days when they're children. And when Elizabeth becomes queen in 1558, Dudley has a position which is called Master of the Horse. That's to say, he is in charge of the royal stables, which then, obviously, as the horse is the basic mode of transport, is very important. But much more importantly than that, obviously, when you have a queen, the whole way in which the royal household, that's the equivalent of the White House staff, is organized is different. The personal attendants who do the most personal things, like dressing and undressing and helping at the toilet and whatever, obviously have to be women, whereas normally they would be men. And the closest post, the one that's the closest personal attendant on the Queen, is the Master of the Horse. And this job is given to Robert Dudley. And very quickly, they shift from being royal mistress and servant to something that looks very much like lover and mistress. And they behave very freely in public. You know, they're touching, they're kissing, they're holding hands. And as you can imagine, the rumor mill churns furiously. Nobody will ever know whether they had sex or not. I mean, it's one of the reasons why Elizabeth is such a magnificent figure of mystery. And there are all these unanswered questions about her. And one of them is she really a virgin? The guess that I've come up with, and it is only a guess, but there's quite a lot of evidence for it, is that they did have sex, but it's like President Clinton. In other words, he had it with her, but she didn't have it with him. But it's a wonderful story.
Mm. Elizabeth's younger brother, Edward, was not on the throne very long after his death. Then her older sister, Mary, became queen, and she was the daughter of Catherine of Aragon and was Catholic. So here, this created a great deal of tension between the two women because they, in a sense, represented those two different faiths and the struggle for which one would be the official faith of the country. During this time that Mary was on the throne, Elizabeth had to be very careful about what sort of public face she showed. But was she indeed, though, actively involved in attempts to overthrow her older half-sister?
I think she probably was. I mean, there's no doubt whatever that she had some involvement in them. She is, of course, incredibly careful. In contrast to Mary, Queen of Scots, when Elizabeth is queen, Mary, Queen of Scots does silly things like put instructions on paper to murder Elizabeth. Elizabeth is far too clever. Everything she does is on a deniable basis, and ambiguous messages, unsigned letters, all this kind of thing. But I think she is involved, and certainly Mary thinks that she's involved, and Mary's bluntly determined to execute her. She would have liked to kill her. She sees Elizabeth as the great risk to making England safe for the Roman Catholic Church. There's an enormous rebellion because this is not only a quarrel between the two sisters, it splits the country. And there's a great rebellion in Kent, which is to the southeast of London, which actually gets into the capital itself. It's defeated, but it's a very close-run thing. Letters are discovered. Communications are discovered between the leaders of the rebellion and Elizabeth, and between Elizabeth and the French ambassador, who's actually been backing the revolt, because, of course, Mary looks to Spain and the two great rival international powers, that period of France and Spain. And England is a kind of dog between, is a bone between two dogs fought over between them. Mary is so convinced that Elizabeth has been involved that she has her arrested, imprisoned in the Tower, accused of treason. She's taken into the Tower, past the great menagerie of roaring lions at the entrance to the Tower, and from that moment onwards she always describes herself as Daniel in the lion's den, and she goes further into the Tower, past the scaffold on which Jane Grey has just been executed, and she sort of looks at it and says, "Is that for me?" And then she's imprisoned, not in a dungeon, as the legend has it, but actually in the rooms in which her mother had been imprisoned before her death. And it's awful psychological torture, but, you know, and she reacts badly. I mean, she gets migraines, she has strange psychosomatic swellings, but she literally keeps her head. I mean, she keeps control of her emotions. She plays the game, she fends off the Inquisitor. She never ever incriminates herself, and finally is released, but still held in under house arrest for another 12 months. I mean, it's an awful story. I mean, She is literally within a whisker of death.
This was Wyatt's rebellion. It was led
by
a man named Thomas Wyatt, who himself was the revolt did not succeed.
He was
executed, and then she, as you say, she was imprisoned. It's again, that seems to be rather remarkable stroke of luck there, that somehow during all of that, that Elizabeth wasn't, that some shred of evidence, or maybe even you wouldn't have needed any, it wasn't produced, and that she would have faced the same fate as Wyatt and her mother and a lot of other people.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that what is important to realize is that even in the Tudor period, they needed some sort of evidence. I mean, you couldn't just do it arbitrarily. The monarch in England then, no more than the President of the United States now, couldn't condemn somebody to death. There had to be a trial. There isn't, we didn't use political assassination or murder at that period. There had to be a trial. There was a jury. The jury had somehow to be persuaded. And it's very clear that nobody would have been persuaded to execute Elizabeth, and that certainty builds up and builds up and builds up, and Mary herself is bitterly resentful about it. We know because she talks about it to the Spanish ambassador, a man called Simon Renard, who is her confidant, and you know, she says, I'm convinced of her guilt, but we can't pin it on her. And you can sense her frustration. I mean, one of the really interesting things about the relationship between the two half-sisters is that Mary constantly is dealt what looks like an absolute winning hand. You know, she becomes queen. It looks as though she's got charges against Elizabeth that will eliminate her. And always Elizabeth escapes. Always she slips away.
We have a couple of callers to bring into the conversation. Other people who are listening are certainly welcome. You'd like to ask a question. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Go anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We'll start out with someone in Bloomington, Indiana, line number 4, right here. Hello.
Hi. Could I ask your guest to comment on Elizabeth's and how some developments in history that occurred outside of the control of Queen Elizabeth affected her success. Now, obviously, she ruled over a cultural and artistic flowering in England. But let me name some things that were also happening. The Renaissance was happening. Didn't she benefit from the Renaissance? Comment on the Renaissance, the vernacular, English vernacular, the printing press, Shakespeare, Sir Francis Drake. Comment on those things one at a time, starting with the Renaissance.
Well, Elizabeth did indeed benefit from the Renaissance. We've already talked about the extraordinary education that she received, the whole idea of that kind of education, and particularly giving it to a woman, is a development of the Renaissance itself. And her connections with it are very, very close. I mean, obviously, she couldn't go to university as a woman. I mean, that doesn't happen in England, really, until the end of the 19th century. But Elizabeth has the next best thing. All her tutors belong to a single Cambridge college, my own university, I'm proud to say, St. John's College, which is the real cutting-edge institution. And interestingly enough, many of her leading advisors and ministers, both when she was young and when she's an adult, also come from St. John's. They're a kind of close-knit intellectual group, and Elizabeth benefits enormously from that. But she can only benefit from it because she's very intelligent. I mean, it's not just something that's actually given to her. Your other point about the development of English as a vernacular, in other words, the use of English rather than Latin, is also very important. But remember, that key development happens a little bit earlier. It happens in the reign of her father. It's once Henry VIII decides to create an English national church, that you get this immense emphasis on English as a great European language, that you put the Bible into English, that you put the Book of Common Prayer into English, that you come up with this wonderful liturgy for the church in English. Now, Elizabeth encounters that directly in this period of youth that we're talking about. I mentioned briefly to David, she doesn't really come to court until she's 11, the first time. She spends a lot of time at court, is at the age of 11 in 1544, and by coincidence, this is the first year that Thomas Cranmer, who is also her godfather, is actually translating parts of the church service into English. And we even know the date on which Catherine Parr, the Queen Regent, because Henry's gone off to fight a war in France, actually acquires the copies of what's called the Litany, the prayers of intercession at moments of tension. We actually know when she first acquires a copy of the Litany in English, and we know Elizabeth uses it, and we know Elizabeth becomes deeply, deeply committed to it. And this sense of an English nationalism based on the English church and the English language and the English sense of nationhood is, of course, the thing that Elizabeth exploits. It's one of the real fundamental bases of her rule. She's constantly going on. You see, her mother is English. Mostly queens are foreign, and, of course, Mary's mother is a Spaniard. Elizabeth says, you know, I've got an English father, I've got an English mother, I am mere English, mere in 16th century English means completely, absolutely. I am mere English. And she plays this for what it's worth. I mean, her whole, the way she's able to arouse patriotism to defend England against the Spanish attack and the Spanish Armada, the great speech that she makes at Tilbury, it invokes both the things we've been talking about. It invokes the Renaissance and the wonderful coloured use of language, but it's given in English. It arouses these English passions, you know. And I have the body of a weak and feeble woman, but I have the stomach of a king, and a king, you know, that thinks foul scorn that Parma or any foreign prince of Spain, you know, should venture against my dominions. It's wonderful stuff. I mean, she talks as well as a Shakespearean speech is written.
She apparently, there was a kind of a combination. She was just the right person.
At the right time.
Yeah, at the right time. Because at the same time, they had a vernacular, but here came the printing press. And
yes.
Here came Shakespeare.
Yes. And the government, of course, again, what's striking is, you know, Elizabeth has this incredible, almost modern awareness of anything to do with propaganda. I'm just putting together a big exhibition for 2003 on Elizabeth for the anniversary of her death. Incidentally, there will be another one in Chicago at the Newbery Library, but mine will be in London. And I was talking to a friend of mine who is the head of the maps department at the British Museum and British Library. And you can imagine maps are very, very important in this period with exploration and all the rest of it. And I was saying to him, does Elizabeth have any interest? He said, no. And then he thought again. He said, oh, yes, she does, if it can be used for propaganda. And, of course, the maps are printed. And so she's got this brilliant sense of propaganda. Her portraits are engraved. Government propaganda is printed because the government controls the printing press. It is a remarkable period. But I think also, just finally, you talked about cultural flowering. I think very often these moments of intense political crisis, like the Reformation, like Elizabeth's restoration of Protestantism, do lead to an immense artistic flowering. We tend to think of the arts flourishing in peace. I don't think they do. I think they flourish when there's real tension, when there are absolutely radical debates and disagreements.
Very interesting.
Don, thank you for the call. It also seems to be the case that not only did she know the power of propaganda, she had a talent for what today we would call spin.
Mm.
I think I'm thinking of the famous story when she came to the throne and she was going through the street and an old man in the crowd turned his back on her and cried, and she singled him out and said, look, the man is overcome with joy.
It's wonderful. He's crying tears of joy.
Yes, and clearly that was not the emotion that he was experiencing at the time.
I don't think so. But she, what is striking, in fact, I was here last weekend when there was the inaugural, which is a kind of, you know, coronation of a president. And it was instructive just looking at the contrast between Bush's inaugural procession going up Pennsylvania and Elizabeth's, which went through the streets of London from the Tower right through to Westminster, a much longer route than just up Pennsylvania Avenue. And whereas you had the president, you know, in a bulletproof limousine that looked, you know, heavier than a tank, and I gather actually is, bulletproof glass everywhere, this complete separation, you know, motorcycle outriders, this complete separation between a president who is supposedly created by popular election, though we do know there are problems in this case. Elizabeth, a monarch by divine right, deliberately exposes herself to the people. She's carried in an open litter. It's wide open to the people on every side. They come up, they press gifts in her hand. Every time she receives one, she's got just the right little turn of phrase. And rather than, you know, the American inaugural, which is just a spectacle, there's no interplay between the president and those in the parade. In the case of Elizabeth's procession, the whole thing is a dialogue between Elizabeth and her people. And it just brought home to me that we think, you know, you think certainly, royal government bad, doesn't respond to the people, Republican government good, elected by the people. If you looked at those, if you compare those two events, you read them completely opposite. You have a president who seems frightened of the people and doesn't interchange, and a monarch who opens herself to them. Curious.
We have a little less than 10 minutes. Our guest is David Starkey. He's a historian. His book, Elizabeth, The Struggle for the Throne, is published by HarperCollins, if you'd like to read it. And we have another caller here standing by in Clay City. So we'll go there. Line number one. Hello.
You've talked about the things that have influenced Elizabeth. What came down from her reign? I mean, every monarch takes from the next monarch a little bit of what they did and adds to it or changes it. What influence did she have? Is there anything that would come down today that I would recognize as a tradition that she started or something like that? I know he's talked a little bit on the subject, but specifically, is there anything that that you can point a finger at and say, well, we do this today because Elizabeth did this? Thank you.
Oh, great question.
Well, we listen to Shakespeare, don't we? I mean, she didn't write Shakespeare, but the events over which she presided are the shaping moments in our culture. The whole idea of an English empire, an overseas empire, is first formulated under Elizabeth. I mean, the thing doesn't actually happen, as I'm sure you know better than I do. The colonies which are started under Elizabeth don't work, Roanoke and all the rest of it. But immediately in the next reign, that idea under James I, that idea is put into practice. But I think the most important thing about Elizabeth, the most important legacy, if you like, is the myth of a golden age. Within a few years of her death, when the new official version of the Bible is produced under James I, the King James Bible, the preface just talks about Elizabeth, and it refers to her as that bright Occidental star, Queen Elizabeth of famous memory. And you already have that sense of myth. And it's that myth, that mythic sense of England's ideal age, which goes on from generation to generation. And it's so powerful that even at the beginning of the reign of Queen Elizabeth II, our present monarch, there was talk, which unfortunately has not been fulfilled, of a new Elizabethan age. So Elizabeth finally is a mistress of myth. She's a great creator of legend, and I think that's there is a great achievement of political stability. She hands on to James I, against all expectations, a unified realm, a monarchy at least as strong as she'd inherited it. She does all that, but I think what's more important, and why, after all, we're talking about her now, is she hands on a myth, a legend. Hmm.
We have another caller here from a car phone, line number two. Hello.
Hi there.
Yes.
I'm really enjoying the conversation today. I want to ask a little bit about Elizabeth's relationship with Mary, Queen of Scots. I've read many, many biographies. I haven't read your book yet, but I will as soon as I can get hold of it. And a lot of times, it seems to be split 50-50 on whether or not Elizabeth really led Mary to marrying Henry Darnley. Some authors seem to indicate that that's sort of what she wanted, and she offered Dudley in place so she could kind of lead her to it and get Mary to react badly and to marry him. And other people say that, well, no, Mary duped Elizabeth and married one of her subjects. What is your view on that?
I think it's the second, which is the case. As far as I understand it, and I hasten to say, the book, and therefore the period on which I've done the most recent research, is just before the one that we're talking about now. It's in the run-up to her accession to the throne. But the work that I've done on the Dudley, on Dudley and Elizabeth, it suggests two things. Elizabeth is serious about offering Dudley as Mary's husband. Dudley is appalled at the thought. The idea of going off from being, a great earl and favourite at the English court to Scotland, which is the equivalent of going to Alberta or something. I mean, it's a million miles from anywhere. It's cold, poor. He doesn't want to do it. And it seems to be Dudley who actually gets permission for Henry Darnley to be allowed to go up to Scotland. But Elizabeth is genuinely appalled that Mary marries him. Mm-hmm. And she is, of course, even more appalled when Mary goes on and is complicit in his murder. And even more appalled when Mary then marries the man who's organized his murder, Bothwell, who's also raped her. And I think that really we've talked a lot about the relations between Elizabeth and her half-sister Mary, with Mary as a kind of model of how not to be a queen. The other model of how not to be a queen is Mary, Queen of Scots. I mean, who is a disaster. And when she comes to England, you know, immediately flings herself into plotting against Elizabeth. Because again, contrary to the romantic legend of, I'm sure, some of the books that you've read on Mary Queen of Scots, the one thing that Mary Queen of Scots is not interested in is Scotland. She'd been born to be Queen of France, and then her husband dies prematurely, and she leaves France with tears streaming down her face. And the moment she gets to Scotland, all she's interested in doing is plotting to succeed to the English throne. And the amazing thing is, Elizabeth puts up with it. And you know, she waits for 20 years before she removes her. I mean, I think she shows extraordinary patience and tolerance. I wouldn't say she was a saint. Elizabeth certainly isn't. But again, she's this terrific reluctance actually to use violence as a solution to political problems.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. We appreciate the call. I just as a way of finishing up, I think that when people think of the image of Elizabeth, perhaps they've seen portraits, perhaps also they think of various portrayals in film, but it is probably the image that we think of is Elizabeth in her maturity. The cover of your book features a painting that's also reproduced in the book that shows Elizabeth as a teenage girl, and apparently it was a painting that she had done for her father. And I think you said that you were very struck by the image and thinking about her at this time of her life, and in fact that when you first saw this picture, you didn't think much of it, and it was only when you realized that this was Elizabeth that you perhaps then started thinking of looking a little bit more at this period?
That's right. I mean, when I first saw the picture, I think it's a beautiful, beautiful painting. Stunning. But I didn't recognize, I mean, the point was, not that I didn't think much of it, I didn't recognize it. I didn't recognize that this was Elizabeth, because she looks so completely different from, you know, the figure with the great piled-up wig and the painted-out face and the fantastic dresses. There's this simple, unmade-up, rather intense teenage girl. And what I wanted to do was to try to understand how that girl became the great queen. And that's what this book is doing. It's exploring the girl behind that picture and trying to do so with new material and a freshness, and above all, the use of eyewitnesses who saw the events that we've been talking about.
Well, we must stop here because we've come to the end of the time. The book we've been talking about is Elizabeth, The Struggle for the Throne, published by HarperCollins by David Starkey. Mr. Starkey, thank you very much for talking with us.
And thank you, David.